You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, January 12th, 2023. My name is Emma Vigeland. In for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Neil Vallely, researcher at Economic and Social Research, Aute Aurora, and author of Futilitarianism, Neoliberalism, and the Production of Uselessness. Meanwhile, the White House has disclosed a second set of classified documents that were found at Biden's Wilmington home. Key part, the White House disclosed this and voluntarily returned them.
It's just like me. Double standard.
Indicators point to December being another month of cooling inflation, yet the Fed remains undeterred. House Republicans have passed two anti-abortion bills that have no chance of getting past the Senate, but they did remind the public that Republicans are insane theocrats. Rumors are swirling about secret backroom deals and quid pro quos that finally got Kevin McCarthy over the hump for speaker on his 15th try. Say it ain't so. Thousands of New York City nurses at two hospitals have reached a tentative agreement for wage and staffing increases, ending a three-day strike. Barbara Lee, longtime anti-war representative from California, has reportedly told other members privately that she will run for Senate in Feinstein's old seat, which she should be vacating if she remembers. That pits Barbara Lee against Katie Porter and potentially Adam Schiff. Just let it not be that guy. Please. Please. Anti-government protests continue in Peru after the ousting of former President Pedro Castillo weeks ago. At least 48 have died in the demonstrations. Putin fired and replaced the general in charge of the war in Ukraine, the second time in 3 months that that's happened. The Intercept is reporting that the New York Stock Exchange will begin listing dual securities with the Tel Aviv Stock Exchange, streamlining the ability of American investors to directly invest in the occupation, construction firms, destroying Palestinian homes, etc. And lastly, it is the 21st anniversary of the reopening of Guantanamo Bay Prison. Over 150 international organizations have called on President Biden to finally close the abusive prison. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Whoa, whoa, whoa. First time in a long time, baby. I'm back. Knocked some of the rust off yesterday, so this is going to be a fire show. Really good one. Matt's happy about it.
Yeah, it's good to have you back, Emma.
Yeah, well, thanks. That's good to be back. I feel very rejuvenated. So it was a long time to be away from work. Mm-hmm. Although I did come in for ESVN during that final week because I was in town during that time period, and I came into the office and noticed that the air conditioning unit is replaced.
Oh yeah.
So, we didn't. Did anyone discuss this? Because this is huge for me. The summer is 6 months away.
A long national or our long office.
Our national nightmare is over.
For me, it was truly I have very poor temperature control.
I mean, so people just need to go back to those shows where the power cut out, especially when Sam was here, and to clock his sort of mood before and after the power.
There were two eras of it, too. There was one before we got the mobile unit, and there when we had no air conditioning at all. That was me more like feeling like I was going to vomit all the time. And then we had the air conditioning unit that would cut our power off.
That we could use to like 25% capacity.
Yeah, I was like, if we
want to get 81 degrees.
You should just had a box fan. You should just got a box fan.
I know. That would have made things easier. But regardless, that was like my big Christmas miracle. Let's start with this because we talk often, I think, about Israeli apartheid on this show. I feel like we could talk about it more because it's one of the great abuses and injustices in the world right now.
It's interesting. Like, on that note, we should talk about it on its own merits, and also on the merits that groups lobbying to sort of maintain that are very invested in our politics, including DMFI and AIPAC.
It is, and also like just the general fact that we fund Israeli apartheid in this country. Your taxpayer money goes towards that. And there are very few members of Congress who are brave enough to speak out against this because of the aforementioned lobby that will come after you, will flood your elections with money smearing you in certain ways. And one of those few who chooses to stand up for what's right in the face of those pressures is Representative Rashida Tlaib. Her and Ilhan Omar, I think, really stand among the rest as vocal, brave voices in Congress pushing back against this. And particularly because Rashida Tlaib has Palestinian family, is of Palestinian descent, this is immensely personal for her. And what's happening right now in Israel, where Benjamin Netanyahu has returned to power for a third time, he has formed a coalition with Israel's furthest right, the most religiously conservative Zionist elements in Israel, Jewish supremacists to a degree. That's the coalition that he has formed with the far right. And the agenda that's on the docket is apartheid on steroids, what's happening in the occupied territories. Here's Rashida Tlaib speaking out about this in her first address to Congress, first floor speech in 2023.
Mr. Speaker, I rise today as the only Palestinian American serving in the United States Congress. I feel a strong responsibility, Mr. Speaker, to humanize the Palestinian people who are living under increasingly oppressive and racist apartheid policies. 2002 was one of the deadliest in memory for Palestinians. Dozens of children were killed by the government of Israel, and many were targeted. Groups like DCI Palestine, who monitor these killings, were targeted. We cannot look away, Mr. Speaker, and gaslight the oppressive and violent policies towards the Palestinian people who are experiencing right now, literally taking away their human dignity and their right to be able to freely live and raise their children without this type of targeting. We can't keep handing over billions each year to an apartheid state violating human rights. And now we are dealing with a far-right government there now promising to make things worse. And they're not even hiding it, Mr. Speaker. They are intentionally saying exactly what they're going to continue to do, which is the status quo, and again, making it very dangerous for Palestinians to live and thrive. No person, not one Palestinian, Israeli, anyone, deserves to suffer or die for who they are, what they believe, or where they were born. The sooner we end unconditional support for Israel's apartheid government, the sooner we can begin making good on that belief. Today, I'm thinking of my Siti, my grandmother, who deserves to have human dignity. She should not be denied of who she is solely because she was born Palestinian to be able to feel safe and to be able to have human rights. I'm also thinking today, Mr. Speaker, of the Palestinian American journalist Shireen Abu Akla and the countless Palestinians who deserve to live, but whose lives were cut short. Thank you again for at least trying to listen and hear from someone that, again, is connected to so many folks on the ground there that, again, deserve to be seen and heard in this chamber. Thank you, and I yield.
And that's exactly it, right? The without her voice, without others choosing to make sure this is resonating, I mean, how much is it resonating? You can't really tell. Probably not that much with most members, but that's why it's so important to have her in Congress.
It's certainly alarming a lot of people. Jonathan Greenblatt of the ADL, the Apartheid Defense League, truly bewildering to see a member of Congress use inflammatory rhetoric and spread disinformation about the Jewish state using the terms apartheid and ethnic cleansing, both wildly offensive and inaccurate.
Human Rights Watch has been calling it an apartheid state for many decades.
That's interesting, maybe something we should talk about later, because Ken Roth has been iced out of a job at Harvard. Ken Roth, who was, I think, the founder of Human Rights Watch, which is, frankly, a human rights organization that is not one that we like to put forward because it's milquetoast.
Right, right. That is the safe assessment. They're also borrowing in their assessment of it from the United Nations, just audit of like what the country is doing.
It's a human rights organization that like is very, I guess, pro-West and was slow to call Israel an apartheid state, but that is what it is.
I mean, when she talks about her grandmother there, right now Israeli forces are in the works to continue to forcibly remove Palestinians from their homes and villages in order to further Israeli settlements. And they'll use a variety of explanations for the cultural...
We're making neighborhoods because they do terrorism.
Yeah, it's either a military operation. We need your home that you've had in your family's generations for a military operation. Do you have a permit for it? No, I don't, because it's nullified or not recognized by the corrupt court system in Israel. Okay, well, we're bulldozing it. Or they just basically straight up say it. This is for Israeli settlers, essentially. And so that's just, you know, one of the many plans that the Israeli government is undergoing. And what they're choosing to do is also further gut the Israeli Supreme Court and undercut their ability to check parliament's, it's essentially like judicial review, which further just makes the court system a green light for apartheid actions. And that's another reason, like, we emphasize this on the show, focusing on legality and this is just because it's legal. It's a fallacy, because a lot of times these legal institutions can be corrupted for political ends like this.
Yeah, and people should stop calling it like the quote-unquote only democracy in the Middle East. It's disgusting to call it democracy. That, as John Kerry said in 2016, John Kerry said, Israel can be Jewish or it can be democratic. It cannot be both.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. But first, we have a word from one of our sponsors, Blinkist. I'm not sure if you guys have heard of Blinkist, but if you want to be a better parent, smarter communicator, better friend, more impactful team member, or just a savvier investor person in society, Blinkist can give you a roadmap to becoming a better version of yourself with curated collections and expert-led guides. So the Blinkist app enables you to understand the most important things from over 5,500 nonfiction books and podcasts in just 15 minutes. So if you don't have time to listen to a full audiobook, you're trying to get information from some of these books that are coming out, and you might have interest in them, but you just have so much going on, Blinkist provides you with an opportunity, Blinks as they call them, to consume information from some of these books without having to take the time to read the full thing, because sometimes you just don't. We all live fast lives. We have a lot going on.
And frankly, not all books are worth reading.
You just
people who think, people like, oh no, you have to read. As somebody who reads a lot of books, like, you don't. A lot of them are full of fluff that the publisher wants to fill, especially business books about, like, let's say Elon Musk or whatever. You take a Blinkist.
I was curious about your take on that, but we have the Lek endorsement there. And, or like, say, you know, there's a biography that's in the press right now, an autobiography, and you want to get some of that juicy information, just do a blink on it. You don't need to read the full thing. So you really just get kind of two things for the price of one. You get titles that you would share with your best friend, and you're able to consume the information in a short period of time. So right now Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/majority report, one word, majority report, to start your 7-day free trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/majority report to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/majority report. And now for a limited time, you can even use Blinkist Connect to share your premium account, and you will get two premium subscriptions for the price of one. So you can share Blinkist with your friends and family. So again, that's Blinkist, Blinkist.com/majority to get a 25% off, Blinkist.com/majority report, I apologize, to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial, Blinkist.com/majority report. Okay, when we come back, we'll be joined by Neil Vallely. We are back, and we are joined now by Neil Vallely, researcher in economic and social research, Aotearoa, and also lecturer of sociology at University of Otago in New Zealand. Sorry if I butchered any of those pronunciations, Neil, and also author of the book that we're discussing today, Futilitarianism, Neoliberalism, and the Production of Uselessness. Neil, thanks so much for coming on.
Hi, Emma. Thanks so much for having me.
Of course, and we should say, joining us from New Zealand, where it is Friday, which is blowing our minds here at the studio, but coming from the future, Neil, to talk about his book. Your book is really touches on so many things that, like, we try to discuss here at the Majority Report. You put it, you know, more eloquently than I could. But what I love is how your book was born, really. It's out of your personal experience with budget slashing to humanities divisions at your university, like social studies, etc. We've talked about this on the show before, how they're deemed indulgent or unimportant, and, you know, go into STEM, something that'll make you money, essentially, because they don't sufficiently serve capitalism, and in fact they challenge many capitalist notion. So what did you observe in your own personal experience with your profession that led you to exploring this a bit more?
Yeah, thanks, Emma. That's very kind. So basically that's where the book started for me. Was I finished my PhD in 2015 here in New Zealand, and about 6 months after I finished my PhD, the humanities division at my university went through a series of huge cuts where lots of staff were fired. And it really made me start to reflect on basically the idea of the humanities as deemed somehow useless by in a kind of social context or political context. And I started to think about what, not simply, you know, to buy into that kind of rhetoric of, you know, we need degrees that are useful in order to get jobs, so on and so forth. It was to think about how does something become constructed as useless? And I spend a lot of time now, you know, teaching students about the kind of contemporary university. And so say in New Zealand, where I'm based, you know, I'm teaching students whose parents would have gone to university where it was free and would have got a bursary to go to university. And now I'm teaching a cohort of people who are paying these crazy fees to go to university and are all in debt. Mm-hmm. And that's a completely radical transformation of what education is. And within that context, things like the humanities have been kind of deconstructed because they're deemed somehow because you're going to get into so much debt, you need to go to university to do something that will get you a job that you can therefore pay that debt back when you're finished. And it's hard to make that argument for things like an English degree, an English literature degree, or a history degree, or so on and so forth. So I was trying to look into the kind of way that humanities have been completely kind of dismantled by this new kind of economic logic that governs the way that universities function. But then the more I started to look into this economic logic, the more I started to look into the idea of uselessness, I started to see that it actually permeates so much of the experience of contemporary capitalism, that it extends way beyond the university into kind of everybody's lives in some way or some shape or form. And that was really the genesis of the book. I started to think about that actually this idea of futility, this idea of uselessness, is actually deeply implicated in the way that neoliberal capitalism functions. And so the book just grew and grew from there and developed into what became.
Yeah, I mean, it's so important to flesh out that utility or usefulness are not things that exist in nature. They're constructed. Mm. And I want to dive into that in a second, but just I'm wondering if you could expand on the differences and maybe that you observed in your students, one where at a university, in their response essentially to your teaching and when they were going to a university that was for profit or paid for, or one that was already, I guess, paid for by the state.
Yeah. I think there's a very justifiable anger with kind of contemporary students and in the differences between what university used to be and what it is now. And I think, I come across lots of students who, for instance, at my university, and I think universities across much of the world, there's a kind of mental health epidemic amongst students, rise of kind of anxiety and depression. This is also kind of wider society, but for students, there's so much pressure on university and they're getting into so much debt. So I come across students who are trying to get through their degree within a kind of shorter period of time so they don't get into so much debt. But then that puts so much pressure on them that they're studying so many courses each semester that they're kind of highly stressed. And they also look at the future in a completely different way to their kind of parents' generation, in that they see themselves getting into debt, they see themselves getting this degree, and then they come out and there's a kind of job market where, precarious work, it's really unclear of what the kind of future holds. They can't afford to buy any property, any housing. They look at the kind of climate, the kind of dumpster fire that we're kind of, that their generation and our generation have to confront. And there's a kind of sense of deep sense of futility of, but why am I getting this degree? Why am I getting into so much debt when there's this kind of future that doesn't guarantee that I will have any kind of prospects? And that's where I was trying to get to with the idea of utilitarianism. It's this sense that students, and it's obviously the book is not just about students, but students are a good example in that they are trying to, on some level, maximize their utility, as economists might call it, which is trying to make themselves as useful as possible. But in doing so, the kind of collective economic and social conditions in which they kind of enter into the world are being dismantled on a daily basis. And there's this kind of gap between their drive and experience to try and maximize utility and the kind of world that they enter.
There's a lot of, you know, online right-wing influencers who are, I think, exploiting a sense of atomization from certain segments of the population. And the reality is that people can look no further than what you discuss in your book, where how does one feel at peace in the society when your identity or like your success in that society is fundamentally tied to your utility, and oftentimes maximizing your utility, as you talk about in your book as well, is just like fundamentally impossible. So it's that in and of itself is quite alienating.
Yeah, very much so. And that's where I'm trying to get with the idea of utilitarianism and extending it beyond, say, the experience of students, is that the more and more you kind of examine kind of contemporary society, you realize that so many of us are engaged in activities that economists would describe as maximizing our utility. So we're kind of at a point where so many people are kind of working longer than ever beyond the hours that they're actually paid for. So many people are trying to learn new skills, get an education, so on and so forth, getting into debt and doing so. And as they keep doing this, it seems like our kind of the collective, the common good is kind of dismantled at the same time by kind of neoliberal capitalism. And part of the trajectory that I try to map in the book is from this idea of what we call utilitarianism, which many people I'm sure have heard of. And I don't want to necessarily delve into the kind of boring political economy history of utilitarianism, but the
base I was planning on it.
Oh, great. Yeah, great. We can fill our boots with Jeremy Bentham and the
yes, exactly.
But the basic premise of utilitarianism is that if each individual maximizes their utility, then it'll lead to the greatest happiness of the greatest number of people. It's a kind of majoritarian ethics. And there's deep problems with that idea, which I can identify in the book. But what I argue is that with neoliberalism, we have flipped into a form of utilitarianism, where individuals, as individuals maximize their own individual utility, it actually leads to the active deconstructing of the common good, of the greatest happiness. So it leads ultimately to the greatest unhappiness of the greatest number of people. And yet we are completely trapped in this scenario, that we have no other choice than to try and maximize your utility, but in doing so, it actively works against our kind of common good. And a few individuals will rise to the top, a few individuals will maximize your utility and benefit from it, but the vast majority of people won't, and they'll get trapped in debt, in the inability to live kind of valuable and enjoyable lives.
Yeah, and I remember studying, well, let's talk about Jeremy Bentham, right, who you kind of trace as the founder, the intellectual, you know, genesis behind utilitarianism. And I remember reading him in college, and the fixation on pain and pleasure as this binary where that rules all human beings. You flesh this out as well, but it creates a very perverse set of incentives if you're going to structure your society around that binary. Can you talk a bit about what his theory about the world is and how it birthed utilitarianism, which, as you trace, eventually does branch, and one of the branches is neoliberalism?
Yeah, so, Bentham, kind of, strange kind of figure, strange kind of thinker. Marx was extremely critical of him. He called him a deeply English phenomenon and a kind of very limited thinker. But his basic premise was, so he identified utility as you say, as the kind of should be the kind of goal of each individual, and he really he saw utility basically as pursuing, in every decision you make, pursuing the thing that gives you pleasure over pain. And the most ethical decision was the one that produced the most pleasure against pain over a kind of long period. And it's interesting for that, for him, he could never quite define how we go about measuring utility, partly because the idea he tried to he thought about utility as if it was some sort of objective phenomenon, mm-hmm. some sort of natural concept that kind of existed in the world, and that actually the things that are constructed as useful or pleasurable and so on and so forth are actually deeply implicated in kind of social structures in which we live, and often governed by the kind of ruling classes who determine what is the most useful course of action for the kind of wider society. They never acknowledge that. Yeah.
And sorry to interrupt, but like the contradiction of pleasure being able to exist in a vacuum, as opposed to at the expense or at the creation of pain of others, which is just like, that's exploitation and that's foundational to the world.
yeah, exactly. And I think the kind of ideas of pleasure that people like Bentham and future utilitarian thinkers put forward are very much kind of Western ideas of pleasure. And it's interesting that for Bentham, he tries to come up with kind of examples of how we measure utility. At one point, he thinks about measuring pulse rate, and then he kind of abandons the idea and eventually settles on money as the measurement of utility. And he says something like the barometer is the measurement of air pressure, the thermometer is the measurement of temperature, money is the measurement of utility. So it's obvious here how this overlaps with kind of capitalist accumulation, capital accumulation. Basically, he's saying that the thing that we must pursue on an individual level is utility, and if utility is money, then the thing we must pursue is money, then we must accumulate as much money as possible on an individual level. And this, of course, kind of is attractive to kind of classical economists and neoclassical economists in the 19th century, and then into the 20th century, the kind of neoliberal thinkers take on a kind of form of utilitarianism that eventually develops into the kind of capitalism that we experience today. But this link between utility and money is deeply is at the heart of utilitarian thinking, and utilitarian thinking has a major impact on the development of economic science over the kind of 19th and 20th century.
And I mean, I think it's might be easier for people to draw the conclusion to neoliberalism and whatever Milton Friedman kind of thinking. But you also contend that it becomes so ubiquitous that it is, in a way, also embedded in the Keynesian model of economic thought. Yeah. And it's kind of fruit from the same rotten tree. How so?
Yeah, so I kind of chart the influence of utilitarian thinking of economic science really diverts with the Wall Street crash and the Great Depression. And you see the development of what I call the book two kind of strands of kind of anti-utilitarian thinking, but two strands that still incorporate the utilitarian ideas into their thought. So one is Keynes's model, which takes the kind of majoritarian aspect of utilitarian thinking and places it at the center. So basically, how do we try and ensure on some level the greatest happiness of the greatest number of people? And so that's to build a kind of strong interventionist model in the economy that becomes the base of, you know, social democratic states, big welfare states, post Second World War, social democracy, so on and so forth. And on the other hand, there's a kind of Hayekian, Friedrich Hayek inspired anti-utilitarianism, which takes the individual aspect of utilitarianism over the individual over the majority, and situates that at the heart of a kind of philosophy of society. And these two anti-utilitarian stances are kind of in competition, through the kind of mid-20th century. The Keynesian model is kind of winning until the 1970s and the kind of economic and social crises of the 1970s, where then the neoliberal form of utilitarianism emerges kind of victorious and becomes the kind of basis of a new kind of hegemonic bloc politically through people like Reagan and Thatcher, and economically through the kind of ideas of institutions like the IMF and the World Bank and so on and so forth. And this becomes the kind of governing logic of the world that we now inhabit.
Yeah, and foundational piece for neoliberalism there, how neoliberalism wins out over the Keynesian model. It's somewhat of like asymmetrical warfare. I mean, we'll talk about it in like the context of why can the Republicans discipline or have more ideological consistency among their fringe members, where it's a bit of a hodgepodge and difficult for the left to use its leverage within the context of the Democratic Party. It's because, well, on that side, they're all in agreement, like industry, capital, business, that's what we're going to side with. And so, the neoliberalism winning out over Keynesian majoritarian economics is kind of the same argument, which is that, well, you might want to lead with something stronger as opposed to playing on their turf.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I think that, and I can identify that in the book, and many other scholars have, is that the kind of left that we encounter now, and I think that's a really perceptive point, is that the right are extremely kind of elite. On some level, they are unified, you're right, all around the kind of certain way that society should be function, as one that we deeply should challenge and is deeply problematic. But part of the problem for the left is that from the 1990s onwards, particularly in the US and in places like the UK and parts of Europe, is that the left embrace neoliberalism. Neoliberalism is the kind of heart of Bill Clinton's project. Same with Tony Blair in the UK, where I'm based in New Zealand, actually, in the 1980s. It's a left-wing government that implements what is called here is the Rogernomics, named after the finance minister. But it was a neoliberal revolution of the economy and society, led by a left-wing government. And what this really did is kind of splinter the left. And Nancy Fraser, the kind of Marxist philosopher, she calls what emerges in the 1990s as a kind of progressive neoliberalism. So it's a neoliberalism that embraces kind of social liberalism, social forms of liberation from kind of certain forms of rights and so on and so forth. But at the heart of it, it deeply embraces a kind of economic model of neoliberalism. And this creates a real problem for the left going forward, a problem that we now encounter in the kind of splintering of left-wing parties. It's a kind of left-wing that's still committed to a neoliberal economic model, and a left that is now developing around kind of democratic socialism or other forms of kind of social democracy. And these kind of, it creates a kind of left that is kind of often confused and introverted and kind of fighting against itself, against its kind of instincts. There's this kind of, particularly kind of now kind of older generation of the left that have kind of implemented neoliberalism, kind of are rubbing up against a new kind of younger left that have seen the kind of impact of neoliberalism, particularly post 2008, post the global financial crisis, and they can see that that this model that was supposed to give us the best of both worlds, supposed to give us kind of economic growth and everything that brings with us, and kind of social liberation, we start to see that it's given us neither. And the left are deeply conflicted on that in a way that the right aren't.
And oftentimes we'll talk about that as institutionalism, right? There is still segments of people on left of center parties that I think like borderline fetishize our institutions at the expense of making people's lives better. How does that fit into your thesis here?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I think one of the best analysis of this comes from Quinn Sebodian and his work, his book Globalists, which is on the kind of the rise of neoliberalism, kind of decline of empire and the rise of neoliberalism. He comes up with this idea of market encasement thesis. And his basically the premise of that, in a kind of simple way, is that neoliberalism is about the protection of the market from democracy. So it's about creating a system of institutions that can encase the market, so that basically democracy becomes about making decisions that do not in any way challenge the kind of the way that the market functions today. So, for instance, where I'm based in New Zealand, so much of kind of political decisions that we can make are about things that have so little to do with the economy. For instance, we had a big referendum on whether New Zealand should change its flag, which is kind of here nor there, but we can't have a referendum on whether New Zealand should embrace kind of IMF models of neoliberal economics. These things are completely outside the realm of democratic politics now. And that's basically the main idea of neoliberalism, is to protect the market using institutions to protect it from democratic decision-making. And the left the parts of the left that kind of embrace these institutions, as you said, a kind of form of institutionalism, are in this sense trying to protect the market from democracy. And that's a real problem for the left. We've seen recently, of course, the last few years, the kind of anti-democratic aspects of the right, which are kind of often violent and kind of nihilistic, and play out on our kind of TV screens. And these kind of in the last week or so, we've seen Brazil with the kind of storming of their Congress and so on and so forth. We can see kind of anti-democracy in those acts, but the left kind of anti-democracy is a lot more kind of insipid and a lot more subtle. But it's exactly based in that kind of institutionalism that you identify. And I think that's a real problem for the left. As you said, we put more faith in these institutions than we do in the idea of trying to make people's lives better. And I think that is a kind of conflict that we're going to have to overcome on the left. We're going to have to flip that around and actually see these institutions as part of the problem.
You mentioned nihilism there, and at one point in your book, you make the distinction and make a note of how futility is not nihilism, which that your book is futilitarianism. So, why did you find it important to make that distinction? Because I think there has been a great amount of nihilism over the past few decades, as a result of, all of the things we described about the isolation and atomization of neoliberalism.
Yeah, and I felt like it was a really important distinction to make, because ultimately, as I say in the book, I see this idea of futilitarianism as a kind of hopeful endeavor, and I get towards that, towards kind of conclusion of the book. But nihilism for me is a sort of end in itself, in that I identify two kind of forms of nihilism using the philosopher Simon Critchley's idea of active and passive nihilism. Active nihilism is a kind of destructive form of nihilism, which we've seen in the January 6th kind of uprising we've seen in Brazil in the last week. So we see it in forms of terrorism and so on and so forth. It's a sense of the world is meaningless, I am basically going to destroy it because it is meaningless. And the more kind of passive nihilism is a kind of acceptance that, that the world is kind of meaningless and you just kind of embrace that. That kind of, and we see that kind of mindlessness, kind of consumption, so on and so forth. There's these kind of two forms of nihilism, and there's lots in between there as well, but those are the two kind of extremes. Forms of nihilism, a kind of acceptance of meaninglessness. But with the idea of futility, what I'm trying to do is trying to identify a kind of experience that so many of us have as a way to try and overcome that sense of futility. So it's a means to an end. And for me, futility is different to nihilism because it's often, it's more kind of unconscious. Nihilism actually requires you to kind of to acknowledge a kind of meaninglessness, whereas futility is a lot more pervasive in society, but most of us are not really conscious of it. And what I'm trying to do with that, the term futility, is to try to identify a kind of common experience that many of us have, and that's one being one of the real what I've been extremely happy with the kind of reaction to the book. So lots of people have said that idea, kind of I can identify with that idea of futility. That name's something that I experience in my everyday life, and I don't want to have that experience. And so that's where I see a difference between futility and nihilism. Futility can be the starting point of starting to build something that is better, whereas nihilism is basically just an acceptance that things are meaningless, and we're just going to just either accept that or destroy it.
In chapter 5, you explore something really interesting about how forms of political action in many countries in the world right now often involve people attempting to exercise their individual economic power, whether it be boycotting things. And, you know, I support BDS, for example, but it's like just that is just that there. I recognize the limitations of that, and how, you know, one's purchasing power is conflated or often melded with one's voting power. That's troubling in and of itself. But how does that fit into the politics of futility?
Yeah, so that's kind of, yeah, as you said, kind of chapter 5 of the book is trying to identify the political impact of futilitarianism. Is that it traps us into, not really through any of our own doing, but traps us into a kind of mindset that political change, political action is the result of individual decision making, and therefore that's where we get into a kind of consumer politics, for instance, where we think, for instance, that buying certain products, so on and so forth, if we all do that, then this will make kind of huge kind of change in the world. And the point you make there about the conflation between kind of purchasing power and political power, I think has become fundamental, particularly, sadly, in a kind of progressive politics. And so, for instance, I look at the idea of voting with your dollar, which several kind of progressive kind of campaigns have kind of either implicitly or explicitly expressed, the idea that you can enact kind of political change by the decisions that you make with your purchases. And what this actually accepts without realizing it is kind of neoliberal forms of depoliticization. It's the idea that you can somehow sidestep the kind of messiness of politics, the kind of the organizing that's required, the kind of democratic decision makings, the struggles that politics requires. You can sidestep all of this simply by just using your credit card. And this actually, this is a kind of almost a neoliberal dream. Many of the neoliberal thinkers actually discuss this idea of voting with your dollar, that the idea that purchasing power becomes the basis of politics. And actually, it's often on kind of what we might think of left politics that has implicitly embraced this depoliticization, and that we start to think that simply that our individual political, what we think are political decisions, are somehow going to kind of enact widespread change, and then we come into the world, we realize that the world hasn't really changed through these individual actions. One very funny experience I had was in a greengrocer's. I don't know what you would call them in the US. Kind of a store that sells fruit and veg. And a woman came in behind me and said, "Look, these apples still have stickers on them. I signed a petition last week to say that we should, that apples should not have stickers on them, and yet they still have stickers on them." This idea that her individual signing of an online petition could somehow enact this kind of structural change to the way that we eat apples was kind of absurd, and yet it was the kind of basis of her kind of political imagination, was simply that through her individual action, it can somehow enact this huge kind of structural change.
Lastly, we had someone write in with a question for you. Dan the Birdman says, could you ask him how neoliberalism affected the healthcare system in New Zealand? Not sure. That's a little bit of a more concrete question, but if you feel comfortable,
I guess that's an important question for kind of anyone based in the US. We have a very kind of different healthcare system here. It's much more modeled on something like the UK system, where it's kind of publicly funded healthcare. But much like the UK, neoliberalism has led to the kind of dismantling of this system. And now the healthcare is really creaking in New Zealand. There's massive kind of waiting lists for surgeries, particularly the kind of cancer treatments are being delayed. Appointments for people to have kind of cancerous cells and so on checked have been extended out. So by the time people get checked, the cancer kind of has accelerated. And COVID obviously had a kind of big impact on that, is that so many of these kind of more routine medical procedures or medical checkups had to be kind of pushed back because COVID was putting such a strain on the system. So neoliberalism has had a different effect on kind of healthcare than, say, in the US, but it has had a big effect in the sense that that austerity and forms of neoliberalization have led to the kind of dismantling of these kind of welfare structures that are New Zealand used to really pride itself. It was a kind of semi-socialist, certainly a strong social democratic state in the 1970s. And it's hard to really overestimate the impact that the neoliberal revolution in New Zealand has in the 1980s. It completely kind of upends society. It goes from one of the most protected economies, most kind of state economy that's governed by the state, to a free market economy almost overnight. And it has this massive, massive impact on New Zealand society. And healthcare is one of those that really goes from being kind of a strong kind of state-funded system to kind of one that now is kind of really creaking at the edges.
All right. Well, I appreciate that answer. Thank you so much. Neil Vallely, researcher at Economic and Social Research, Aotearoa, if I'm saying that correctly.
And Aotearoa.
Aotearoa. Yeah, and also a lecturer of sociology at University of Otago in New Zealand. Thank you so much, Neil, for your time today. The book is Futilitarianism, Neoliberalism, and the Production of Uselessness.
Cool. Thank you, Emma.
Yep, of course. And links will be in the description, all that, if you want to check out Neil's book. I really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much. All right, folks, with that, we are going to wrap up the first hour of this program. We are going to head into the fun half, where we will be taking your calls, reading your IMs, doing some clips, having some fun. Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Yeah, Left Reckoning, we had our 100th episode. We had Brian Mirror on to talk about Lula and the sort of storming of different governmental buildings and the subsequent Lulag, I guess is what the right-wingers are calling it. And
love it.
I'd say, you know, rotten the Lulag as far as I'm concerned. And we also had Bhaskar Sankara on to talk about the state of the left. And R.M. Brown in the post game. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access to all that.
Just also wanted to know, because we were talking about this after the show yesterday, we just all totally forgot. Friday was the Majority Report's 3,000th episode.
Wow.
Just thought that would be interesting.
Now, keep it moving, that. Bradley. We don't dwell on stuff like that.
Anyway. 3,000 episodes on YouTube, or like, are we counting? Like
podcast episodes at least?
By the podcast number. I mean, we've uploaded like 3,100 or something like that.
Yeah, okay, because we're not counting the radio show, too, can't be.
No, yeah, probably just a podcast.
Okay, well, check out Left Reckoning, and also, if you guys are in New York...
January 22nd, the Cutting Room floor. We should put the links to this in the descriptions to everything, but I believe you can get it at... Let me see what... There's some sites you want to check the site. We need to get the right one, actually, because... there's a Ticketweb one. I think that'd be good, because there's one site that like is reselling them for like a really weird markup. I don't know
what
that's about, but 25 to 35, that's what the price should be. If
so, go to Eventbrite.
This is Revolution Left Reckoning. Get your tickets, folks, particularly if you want to be in the meet and greet before the show. There's a limited number of those left. This is Revolution Left Reckoning with Emma Vigeland, Sam Cedar, Bhaskar Sankara, and Ben Burgess, Jason Miles, me, David Griscom.
Fun stuff. Can't wait for that. And on ESVN today, we are back live, and we're basically doing a mega episode, ESVN regular plus OT, because it's the playoffs. Playoffs? Yes, it is.
You kidding me?
Yeah. It is very exciting times in the NFL, although, as always, there's a lot of controversy to talk about. We're going to be giving our picks against the spread for the wild card weekend, where I think we're going to expand to over-unders for the playoffs, just because we have fewer options at that point. But I also want to talk more about the DeMar Hamlin situation, the reaction to it from the NFL, how they really kind of successfully papered over it with t-shirts and hats and good PR. And also some of the like grossness that's happening down with the Houston Texans, who have fired their second black head coach after one-and-done years in deliberately tanking seasons, what that means for a historically racist organization, how that fits into Brian Flores' lawsuit against the NFL, which is still ongoing. So youtube.com/ESVN show. Also, I want to do something like a vibe check for these non-playoff teams. The teams didn't make it. How we're feeling about those teams going into next season. So youtube.com/ESPN show. Check us out there. All right. We are heading into the fun half now. 6-4. We have Brandon. Okay. Let's have Brandon in because I want to hear what's happening on the discourse. It's been too long. Hello. Hello. I can hear you.
Oh, 1 second. Sorry, Brandon. I just got to refresh his...
All right. While we're doing this, we'll read some IMs. Banana Republican says, I hope the lady from the grocery store who hates fruit stickers kindles a general strike. Great interview today. Thank you. Thank you. Lindsay from BK says, Emma, I just want to say you're doing great work on ESVN. I have a friend who doesn't listen much to political shows, but he loves your show. I think you fill a valuable space in sports. Coming from a leftist perspective, that's very kind. I appreciate that. Brandon, hello.
Hello. It's been a while.
It has been. What's happening on the discourse? Happy to see you, too.
This year is going to be the year we get together. That's what's happening on the discourse.
Okay.
Stay tuned.
New Year's resolution?
No. Because that makes it sound like I'm not speaking the truth. I'm
Then it would be a lie. Yeah.
It's only a lie if I acknowledge it as a lie before it doesn't come true.
Right. Gotcha.
But it's going to come true. You've confused me, Emma. Your word games have left me befuddled. But no, this year it's happening.
I should be a debate bro then.
I think people are going to be disappointed when I pivot more to like crypto interviews, because that's definitely what's, you know, in the works right now for a little bit.
I mean, I think people can't get enough of that. So, so check that out. We have Binder. All right, great. We got rolling in. There's Matt Binder. And we're setting up his shot.
We're all back. It's crazy. It's been forever. How long has it been? 3 weeks? 2 weeks?
I mean, since Thursday before Christmas, which was on a Sunday. Yeah. So, whew, not 4 weeks. 3 weeks. Yeah.
I've just been so busy with the holidays and with work. I had no idea.
No audio from you, Matt. So we might need to do this in the interview a little bit.
Hello?
How about now?
There we go.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, Matt Binder. What is happening on Doomed and Scam Economy?
Oh, on Doomed on Tuesday, which was my comeback to Doomed 2, because I took a week off for the holidays, just like you guys. And then last week, I was not on vacation. For some reason, people think I had some long extended vacation. I was working this week. I was I heard someone was on a nice long vacation. Where'd you go with that nice tan and everything?
Oh, well, thank you for noticing. I guess I can say now because I'm not there anymore. I was in Costa Rica with my family. So I was there just for a week, but the vacation
was tacked on
the week that we were supposed to come back.
Yeah, right.
Got it. Honestly, the reasoning is
that I had to link it up with my sister who's in school. So we had to do it on her break. I'm not a crazy slacker. That's the situation. Go on.
That's just how you use your vacation time efficiently. That's not being a slacker.
That too.
So we're trying to labor discipline.
Well, last week, while you were in Costa Rica, I was in Vegas, which sounds like I had fun, but I assure you it was all work. I did not play a single game, not a single slot. CES was in Vegas. And, it's the biggest tech show in the world. The annual CES event, and I was there covering it. And some fun and interesting and not so fun takeaways. And so the episode of Doom that aired on Tuesday, which you could all go check out at youtube.com/MattBinder and soon at doomedcast.com, was with Owen Higgins, which some of you might know from Twitter. He also was at CES. I ran into him and we hung out a little bit. And so we did an episode on the good, the bad, and the dystopian coming out of CES, because there's some interesting tech, there's some bad tech that seems very stupid, and then there's tech that makes you go like, this is not good. And I don't mean not good in like a technological standpoint. I mean like it's bad news for society. So that's the episode. Check that out. And Scam Economy will return this week too. It was supposed to come back already, but I got sick, of course, this week. The world wants me to be out for a third week, I guess. But Scam Economy will air this week, and I have an interview with Molly White looking back at the biggest crypto failures and scams and grifts of this past year, including a number you definitely have never heard of that did not get like the mainstream or even like the mainstream tech press. So definitely check that out at scameconomy.com. It'll be going up later this week.
Binder, on CES, did you see the TCL Next paper tablet? I'm just curious.
I think I did. I think I passed by it. I didn't get the chance to like demo it or like to get a good look at it. Mm. But yeah. Usually screens aren't my thing, but I this year I came across these 3D displays that don't use glasses. And my takeaway after seeing this was if the whole metaverse and virtual reality bullshit that these big companies so badly want us to adopt, if it wants to go beyond just being for, you know, it already exists for gamers, and gamers are fine putting on that headgear to play a game for an hour or so. But like companies like Meta, aka, you know, Facebook's parent company, they want people to use this for everything, hanging out, Zoom meetings, work, all this stuff. And that's never going to happen because the majority of people don't want to put that shit on their head and walk around with it.
They don't even want to put Google Glasses on their head. They definitely don't want to put like a fucking helmet on their head.
Right.
You know, I think that's because they're starting from the standpoint of like, wouldn't it be great if we were able to capture all this data? Like, wouldn't it be great if we were able to get
closure.
To do a lot more stuff using our platform? Like, you know, a lot more shopping, a lot more sort of like geospatial stuff, maybe. Like, you know, we'll be able to more accurately track eye movement with those glasses or whatever, you know. And the fact that people don't need any of that stuff or want it kind of is not the point. It's like, it's about, you know, more efficiently capturing data or trying to capture more data, because they've just run out of ways to capture data at this point, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's like the concept of enclosure that a lot of like sort of Marxist writers about, Peter Linebaugh and Marcus Rediker, write about it, which is, you know, not just the lords in Europe saying, I own this forest now, or in America, we say, no, this is the American states and not like this indigenous groups. But there's also enclosure of like the factory itself was an enclosure of work that was done at the home under your own sort of like, you didn't have like a boss, sort of a factory boss. That's another form of enclosure, and this is literally similar to that, like another form of enclosure by bosses, but we're selling it to people as like some sort of new fun technology.
Well, we had an author on, I feel like, to talk about this, right, Matt, where it was like how tech is enclosure of like one space and attention and mind.
That sounds great. I don't remember.
Anyway, I can't remember anything. But we'll talk about this more in the fun half. 6462. Wait, did you do Doom Dance Scamcon?
Yep.
You got it? Okay, cool. 646-257-3920. We'll see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Hell of a lot of bank. Okay, I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. Hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on.
What?
Come on.
What?
Come on. Someone needs to pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.